Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. Some interesting news from Health Canada last month on its regulation of psychedelic compounds. As of January 5th, restricted substances such as MDMA and psilocybin are no longer excluded from the special access program, which means doctors can apply for access to psychedelic medicines on behalf of their patients, opening the door to safe, legal, clinical delivery of psychedelic-assisted therapies in Canada. Very important news, very exciting, and I think maybe most because it's an important acknowledgement by Health Canada of the therapeutic potential of these medicines. And frankly, I hope it's just the beginning of a new approach to how psychedelics are regulated in this country. To mark this exciting moment, I wanted to interview someone who could be something of a guide to the dawn of this new era of psychedelics and mental health. And I think I found the perfect person, actually. So Dr. Rosalind Watts is a well-known psychologist in the UK. She's got a ton of experience doing psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy for depression in research contexts, most notably at Imperial College London. And in addition to all of her academic achievements, Roz has all the qualities of an amazing psychedelic therapist. Her humanity, her compassion, her wisdom, they're all kind of like off the charts, as you'll see or hear in the interview. I found her perspective on the healing potential of psilocybin to be refreshingly down to earth and yet somehow still inspiring. And I was especially touched by her use of the seasons as a metaphor for understanding our emotional lives. She encouraged us to think about depression as a kind of winter. Now, winter can be beautiful in its own way, but it can also be cold and isolating and numbing. And the challenge when encountering these more difficult aspects of winter is to not get stuck, to allow the seasons to cycle through. And this discussion was a beautiful reminder to me, feeling a little stuck myself in this brutal Omicron winter, to connect and trust impermanence. And I hope it offers you some equanimity as well. Our discussion also covered Roz's much-discussed New England Journal of Medicine study comparing psilocybin to traditional antidepressant, the impact of the therapeutic relationship in healing, the role of psychological flexibility in mental health, Roz's development of the ACE model, which is her innovation on ACT for psilocybin therapy. And she actually guides me through an ACE body scan, which I found particularly interesting. Her evolving approach to psychedelic integration, and the challenges that she's seen in integrating psychedelic-assisted therapy into mainstream healthcare. Finally, you can find the Mindspace podcast on all your favorite podcast platforms like Apple, Google Play, Spotify, etc. And if you're interested in watching the interview, you can find it on YouTube as well. So without any further delay, here's my interview with Dr. Rosalind Watts. Dr. Rosalind Watts, welcome to the Mindspace Podcast.
Thank you, Joe. Lovely to be here.
Great. How's the day so far?
Yeah, it's been a hectic one, but in a very nice, my friend's house, which is relaxing and soothing. And I've got my kitten sleeping at my feet. So that's pretty good.
Very nice. Some embodiment for you there, which we might talk about later.
Yes.
Okay. So let's start with, what exactly do you do and how did you get into this work?
So, I'm a clinical psychologist, and in the last 5-6 years, in fact, 6 years now, I've been working with psychedelics exclusively. I no longer work in other forms of therapy, just psychedelic therapy. And I got into this work through a friend of mine who had had an ayahuasca experience that had really, really helped her depression. And I was quite skeptical about it and thought it sounded like a very strange thing to be doing and that she might die. I read some things online that said, you know, some awful stories of people dying in jungles and, was very, very concerned. But actually, you know, all these years later, very, very grateful to her for having that experience because she, you know, that thing about words have a certain amount of power, but actually seeing something for yourself. So reading people's accounts about psychedelic therapy is one thing, but when you actually know someone that has been through it and it's worked for them and you see the change in them, it's something that you really feel and resonate with. So when I saw my friend the first time after she came back from Peru, it was an energetic shift that I just felt. And so I went to volunteer as a sitter at the Imperial Psychedelic Research Group, where they were just starting their psilocybin for depression research. So I went there in my maternity leave just to get the experience of sitting with people through their experiences and learning about what it was all about.
Very cool. And what do you do now exactly?
Now I do two things. One of them is I am a consultant psychologist for a trial looking at DMT as a treatment for depression. And similar to what I was doing with psilocybin for depression, so working on the therapy protocols and designing protocols and creating visualization scripts and all those things. And then the other part of my work is I have started an integration community, which is a company that I am the founder of. It's kind of my own project. Yeah, I really recognized that in all the psychedelic work I was doing with people, the integration phase was often the most important one, and it was the one that was not provided for. So in the clinical trials, people have these experiences and they have one or two integration sessions, but we know that integration is a much longer process and you need people around you who are familiar with the principles of psychedelic therapy, which are obviously so different in some ways to more conventional models of healing or therapy. So yeah, I wanted to start something up that was for people after the psychedelic experience.
Yeah, so this is ostensibly an interview about psilocybin, but I have a feeling we're going to actually spend a lot of time talking about the therapy piece because, because I've heard you talk about some of the limitations of doing this kind of research in a more structured scientific research setting. So yeah, maybe I'll just put a pin in that one because I definitely want to do a deep dive.
Yes.
So do I understand then that you're no longer involved with the Imperial College London Psilocybin for Depression study?
No. So when there were two psilocybin for depression studies, the first one was a pilot study, which was 20 people with treatment-resistant depression, open label. And then the second one was a randomized control trial comparing psilocybin with escitalopram, an SSRI antidepressant. And they were the only two studies planned for the Imperial group. And so when that second study completed, it actually had to finish slightly early because of COVID. Yeah, that was the depression research completing. And there now is a study looking at psilocybin for anorexia. And there will be some other, I think a psilocybin for chronic pain as well by the UK researchers. But yeah, the psilocybin for depression research at Imperial has completed. There is research looking at psilocybin for depression at King's College, London. So yes. A different one. And I'm sure they're going to be psilocybin for depression studies all over, I think, soon. But yeah, the Imperial one has finished.
I wanted to ask you, and like, I definitely don't want to like tax your brain too much here, but could you give us a little bit of a tour of the highlights of psilocybin for depression research? Like what do we know right now about how effective psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy is for the treatment of depression?
So we really thinking about my own kind of experience of going through those two trials with people and remembering the people and the faces and the experiences. So I think what I can talk about is kind of what I know. And then there's of course the data and that, you know, that it's the second study has just been written up for the New England Journal of Medicine. And so you can find the outcomes there, the study results, which overall, the key finding was that in the study that we did finishing in 2020, comparing psilocybin with an antidepressant, that they were both effective at reducing self-rated depression scores and that they were not significantly different. So the finding there was psilocybin and escitalopram both reduce depression, and they're not, psilocybin isn't actually better than escitalopram, which doesn't really kind of tally that well with people's, you know, like with yes. like anecdotal reports. So I can explain to you, I think, the difference.
Yes. If I could just say, like when I first came across the finding, I was like kind of disappointed.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, first of all, holy smokes, a study of psilocybin in the New England Journal of Medicine of all places. How cool. And then I, you know, got to reading and it's like, huh. That's actually kind of a bummer. This yes. We're in a narrative here about psychedelics are about to save the world. And basically it's no better than, you know, these dreaded, ubiquitous yes. SSRIs that mask symptoms and have these weird kind of like tolerance issues. And, you know, every second person on the planet is taking them and we're still a mess. Like, yes. Okay, so bring us back to reality here, Ross.
Yes. Well, two things to say. In a moment, I'll talk about why actually it wasn't actually like those results in a way were quite misleading. And I'll explain why. And that actually the experience of the participants, I think, were the psilocybin treatments were very much more approved of by them. And I'll explain why and why the study wasn't able to capture that fully. But also to say, based on your point about, you know, the narrative is that psilocybin is going to, I think there is, in a way, something quite valuable in this finding of, let's be grounded here and say, it's working and it was safe for many people, not working for everyone. Psilocybin is working and it's safe, and escitalopram is still, you know, one of the gold standard treatments. So let's not go ahead of ourselves saying like, it's the best thing in the world, and actually being quite respectful to our colleagues in psychiatry and psychology and saying, you know, it's good to be humble, walk slowly, and be gentle in our proclamations about psilocybin. So I'm just giving that in there as a caveat that in a way, although obviously we were all kind of like, we couldn't pretend that we weren't hoping that psilocybin was going to come out significantly more effective, there was almost something slightly, there's something, well, you know what it's like with psychedelics. You work with psychedelics and you start to, you know, this mantra of like, trust the unfolding, like trust the way things, the innate intelligence of how things are moving forward. And I did really, when I realized it wasn't significantly different, I felt the sense of quiet okayness with that, and that maybe that was where we are right now, and that these kind of world-changing narratives can overblow psychedelics, making them into this kind of big bubble that could potentially burst. And also this deep belief that I have that it's not actually the psychedelic, it's that they're amplifying, the real medicine is the container, the therapeutic relationship, and that psychedelics are beautifully amplifying that in a way that can make therapy so much more effective than otherwise. You know, a paper in a journal like that, where it's very much focusing on the medical aspect of it as if it's like a drug intervention, putting too much emphasis on this drug being this kind of miracle drug, I think has problems and limitations too. So yeah, I mean, I think what I really wish is that, going back to the first point about why actually psilocybin, you know, why the paper didn't really kind of uncover the nuances, I would have loved in a way, I suppose it's just different journals have different kind of styles, but I would love the softer story to also be told, which is, I guess, which I'll tell you now, which is, so in the study, the design of it was that we had two groups of people. And they each went through the same therapy protocol. So that was the Accept, Connect, Embody protocol, which I wrote beforehand, which is a very, very minimal protocol. It's non-directive. It's just a framework for understanding the experience, which I can tell you more about in a minute if you'd like to know more details. But just to say that both groups of people, so the escitalopram group and the psilocybin group, both went through the same protocol, the same. So the people in the psilocybin group, they had these two sessions with two therapists and the music playlist in this beautiful room. And they had preparation and integration sessions, I think like 10 sessions all in all with the therapists. So it was a, you know, therapy protocol with these two high dose psilocybin sessions. And then they had 6 weeks of sugar pills as well in between. The other group had the same thing, but in their psilocybin sessions, these music sessions with the two therapists and all of that, the psilocybin was just 1 milligram, but they still went through the whole psychedelic therapy protocol of holding the hands, of visualizations, trusting themselves to let go. They had all the same guidance about surrendering. They had the incredibly powerful music playlist, and they had a really strong bond with the therapist because you have to develop that bond. Otherwise, it's not safe to go ahead. So they had a really strong bond, and then many people found the experiences really profound. So, and then they had 6 weeks of escitalopram. So what it looks like in the journal write-up is we're comparing escitalopram drug and psilocybin drug. And the truth of it couldn't be more different. It's like, no, we're saying that, you know, all of these people went through this therapy protocol, which is different to normal therapy because it's not about changing your thoughts. I mean, that's very, a bit kind of disparaging of me about CBT, but it's a protocol that's all about accepting, connecting and embodying. And they go through all of that with their two therapists that are allocated them for the whole period of time and the music. And no wonder both groups did well. And I really don't think, although obviously I can't really prove this, that it was the escitalopram. In the low dose group, I don't believe, from what they told me, from what I saw, that it was the 6 weeks of escitalopram that made the difference. I witnessed people in those sessions holding hands, being there, having amazing insights and not knowing whether they'd had psilocybin or not, because they had a really powerful session and cried tears they hadn't cried for decades. So psilocybin, escitalopram, yes, it was all about the therapy.
That's quite something, quite a different narrative. Yeah. That you pick up from reading the journal article. You know, this might be a bit of a tangent, but I recently read your colleague, Robin Carhart-Harrit's piece about context. Right. And the possibility that one of the important mechanisms of action with at least, let's say, the classic psychedelics is this enhancement of sensitivity to context. And that when the context that someone's in a psychedelic therapy is like, you know, one or two very caring, open, non-judgmental therapists, a room that's conducive to relaxing, letting go, and healing, that it provides a kind of like accelerator or catalyst, I think would be the best word, for the therapeutic potential of the individual. Mm-hmm. Somehow, in comparing the two conditions, we didn't see that sensitivity taking place. Although, were they taking the SSRIs before going into the two like experiential sessions?
So the first session, no. So they had prep session, and then they had the first music low-dose psilocybin session, and then integration. Then they started taking the daily escitalopram, and then 3 weeks later, they had another session. So their second session, they were on the antidepressant. The first session, they weren't.
Really interesting. So what do you make, you know, this is again a little inside baseball, but what do you make of, you know, the hypothesis coming out of Robin's model that it should create enhanced sensitivity? Maybe these participants were already very sensitive and already quite benefiting from the therapeutic relationship. I wonder, what's your take on that?
Well, my take was that people came into the study with very high expectations. Compare that to the first study where people hadn't really, you know, there was not the same media kind of thing going on. So people came in with high expectations and they were really, really ready. And in order to get through, we had an incredibly careful screening process where, I mean, we were basically cherry picking, really. I mean, we were kind of really like choosing people who we felt were really, really ready. We chose people who were ready for the work, who were in supportive environments, who we felt would be able to safely go through this experience. So we were really cautiously screening. So I think by the time people came through to us and they were absolutely ready and primed and knowing this is a once in a lifetime experience and opportunity, and then we have all this time to get to know people. I mean, you know, therapy sessions, 50 minutes, but 50 minutes is such a short space of time to get to know someone. And it's the classic therapeutic hour. But in our prep sessions, we had lunch the day before the first session. We had lunch with people because I was really keen on how can we develop proper bonds and trust in a short space of time. So we had lunch with people as, you know, equals. The traditional boundaries of I am the expert and you are the patient went out the window, and we sat as three human beings in a room, listening to music, eating our lunch together, and just being with each other. And we were there for lunch, and then we had as long as we needed in the afternoon doing this visualization work together. It really forms a bond. So already by the time we went into the first session, I really felt like we were genuinely co-travelers, and that you don't get that so quickly in therapy. Sometimes you don't ever get that in therapy.
Yeah, and it speaks to the possibility that psilocybin is not the only way to create relationships, to create conditions for healing. And so it's just actually so fascinating. And I wanted to ask you how complex it is to do this work in the context of this sort of very valuable institution or just kind of like practice of rigorous science, whether it's like the pharmaceutical model or even just basic science on these substances, and even just doing, you know, research on complex experiences like this. Maybe we've spoken to it. I wonder if there's anything else you would add around the challenges of doing psychedelic research, or psychedelic therapy research, I think would be more precise.
Yeah, well, like I guess there's always this tension between, you know, the kind of like the scientific purity and making sure that people have enough care. So, Yeah, I mean, I think there is a tension that exists, but you can kind of find the right, you know, you can work together and find the kind of sweet spot, which I think, you know, I think we did. I think we were able to, the protocol we had was, you know, we just made sure that both groups had the same one. So one of the challenges there is that, you know, in the low dose session, as two therapists, you wanted to be kind of the same as you were in a high dose session. So what that means is that when people have the 1 milligram, sometimes people had a really strong response and they didn't know they weren't on a high dose and they really went into it. Sometimes people had a lot of disappointment. And so what they wanted to do was take their headphones off and the eye shades off and sit up and say, I haven't had it. And I'm, you know, and talk through their disappointment. And to us, you have to balance a bit of that, but you also are aware that you don't want this session to be vastly different to the high dose sessions. Otherwise you have a confounder. So what we would say to people in the preparation is, you know, this is really an opportunity away from your normal work, away from your normal relationships, to have a day with yourself. This is about you and the music. Let's take the emphasis off whether there's strong psilocybin or not strong psilocybin, because, you know, everyone reacts differently anyway. Let's really put the emphasis on you having a journey inside yourself. And so that did help quite a lot, but it's still really hard for somebody when they're really disappointed and you're encouraging them to keep going inside and see if they can, you know, it felt really tough.
And track your own expectations and disappointments and hopes for the clients. It's something that people not following the research wouldn't necessarily be sensitive to. It's very challenging for the therapists. When you talk about like 1 milligram, I'm guessing you're talking about synthetic psilocybin in this case?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's a microdose.
Yeah. And what would be the dose for the actual, like the macro dose?
25.
Okay. Okay. Now, you've got quite an interesting story, I believe, about how you decided to take care of the people who didn't get much integration support after the, you know, through the study, and how you took care of them after. Can you share that?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously in clinical trials, finding that sweet spot means that you have to be, you know, the intervention is psilocybin or escitalopram. It's not psilocybin plus the therapy has to be limited to support around the experience itself. It couldn't really provide therapeutic intervention afterwards. With that in mind, and also the other thing is that the people on the low dose group who didn't receive any benefit needed to go back on their treatment as usual, so antidepressants. So the end point of the study had to not be too far away. Otherwise, for people that didn't get any benefit, whether they were in the low dose group or actually some people in the high dose group didn't get any benefit, we didn't want them to be waiting too long before they could go back on, you know, other treatments. So it was a very short window of integration. And actually that was made shorter for some people because then COVID hit. And the last few people in the trial didn't get their second session of psilocybin and they didn't get any integration. And some of the people did get both sessions of psilocybin, but they missed their in-person integration. So Michelle Baker-Jones and I, so Michelle is, she's my kind of psychedelic therapy twin sister. We both, on the same day, we both decided to volunteer for the Imperial trial at the same time. And we both went to meet the team at the same day in the pub. And it was one of those things of like, hello, sister. Hello. You know, we just kind of have become inseparable ever since. But so we realized in COVID that we needed to set something up for people who were now in a pandemic, whose depression was coming back, because, you know, with our people in our study, the depression went for a few months, but it was for most people a few months and then it started coming back. And so we wanted to create something for people to meet each other, because in the first psilocybin for depression study, one of the loveliest moments was when at the very end, Robin wanted to have a gathering in the pub. So all the people that had been in the study were all invited to come and meet all the team. And we all just had lunch and had a drink, and all the people that had been in the trial got to have a chat with someone else who'd been through it, someone with depression and someone openly with depression, someone that's like able to really talk about that and, you know, able to really share about what that's like, but also what the experience of psilocybin for depression was like. And just seeing people avidly talking and swapping numbers made us realize how important that community aspect is. But yeah, so after the second study, we never got to have the gathering that we had planned for people because of COVID. So we started this Zoom group, and it started off as Michelle and I saying like, is this a good idea? Is this going to work? And we had this kind of feeling of like, it might not be a good idea, but it was one of those things that just really came to life. We just opened a Zoom room, said, anybody that wants to come and, you know, meet others from the trial's finished, come and just share. And it was one of those things where it just gathered a life of its own, and the participants would come regularly every week and just completely bond with each other. And Michelle or I, when we were kind of hosting it, we realized that we didn't need to say anything. In fact, it was much better when we didn't, because actually the power of hearing from someone else that's been through your own quite niche experience was so, it was so deep for people that, yeah, it was beautiful to watch.
It's incredible, eh? Just the notion that we could study this stuff in a lab and then publish papers and like, okay, we're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. That's not really the way these things work, right? It spills over very quickly.
Yes.
What, you said you weren't sure it was going to be a good idea. What would have been a bad idea, or what was the risk there?
Well, so after this, then it kind of developed into, because I was so kind of taken with the power of that, it then became the basis for various other projects I've done, which are all about sharing circles for people after psychedelic experiences. But actually, for one of these projects I did, which was with Synthesis Institute, at one point, you know, having from one of my supervisors there, really, really experienced, wonderful psychiatrist, really experienced in the psychedelic space, I said, you know, we're going to set up a kind of year-long program for people with depression to be able to access psychedelic therapy, group retreats supported by therapists, and then also integration groups as a group. And the response of this supervisor was like, that's actually, you know, it might not be a good idea, because in his experience, putting people together, groups of people when people are feeling really depressed made people feel worse, made each other feel worse. And it felt like the people were becoming increasingly hopeless. So he said, you know, in the lead up to the retreat, it's not going to be helpful. And then it might be more helpful after the retreat when people are feeling better. But then when the depression comes back, it's going to go back to making people feel worse. But actually, something inside me wasn't sure about that, because I remember doing training with the Samaritans, which is, I don't know whether you have it over there, but Samaritans in the UK is a befriending service for people. It's a phone line when people are feeling suicidal, they can call. And I remember the training there, they always said to us, you know, always ask people about suicide, always ask them, ask the questions that feel difficult, because you might think you're putting an idea into somebody's head, but actually you're not. You cannot put ideas into people's head. People are feeling how they're feeling. And if you give them an opportunity to share it, it doesn't make them feel worse. It's just a release. It's a relief for people when they're carrying these awful feelings that are sometimes unspeakable. When someone speaks to them and say, if you're feeling that, please tell me, because it's okay. So much more protective and better than the elephant in the room that we don't want to talk about. So because of that, and that proved to be so true in the work that I did with them, that I thought, you know, because I don't suffer from depression myself. So that's always been a bit of a difficulty for me, that I don't have that personal insight into what it is like to be depressed. I've spoken to my friends that have suffered from depression, but because I haven't had that lived experience, sometimes I worry there are things I don't get. But when I thought, really tried to identify with that, and I thought, you know, imagine if I'm carrying around this weight inside me and I'm with a group of other people and they're all describing the same weight. Is that going to make me feel more hopeless, or is it just going to make me feel seen and like I'm not alone and like it's okay to share it? And that was exactly what happened. It was like this physical thing of taking the masks off. Like when the Zoom group opened, it was almost like you could physically see people taking off the mask that they carry around with them all day, pretending things are okay because they feel that they should, and they don't want to make people worry. They don't want to be a drag, and taking off the mask and just being able to, in their sharing time, say, yep, I feel absolutely hopeless and desperate. And it was okay, because that was how they felt, you know, and then somebody else would hear them and nobody would respond to each other or try and fix it or offer advice. Then their time would finish, and then the next person would share about how they felt. And actually they all just felt this sense of relief. We are all in this very dark place and we are all here together.
How beautiful. It's interesting actually listening to the story, because you said when the depression comes back, or these people feeling hopeless and connecting maybe around that, part of me wants to say, well, wait a second, these people did psilocybin. And one session of psilocybin, life-changing, mystical experience, depression is cured, it's like surgery, let's get on with it, get it into the drinking water so people don't feel depressed anymore. That's not really what happens, is it?
No, I actually just felt a tear come to my eye when you said that. Like I had this real surge of emotion, because I remember that narrative and really, you know, thinking that was going to be the way forward. And then the experience of working with people long term has shown me that it's absolutely not. It's, we wish it was, but no, it's absolutely the depression came back for everyone that I was still in touch with. There may be a few people for whom it really, really shifted something and have stayed, just a very small number of people. But I'm talking out of, like, you know, 80 people, like maybe 3 or 4. But for most people, it comes back. And the metaphor that I really started working with, and the one that then has kind of been the foundation for the work I've done since, is of the cycles of nature and the seasons in nature, and the fact that, you know, starting to think about like a psilocybin experience as like a kind of spring summer opening, and then there will inevitably be autumn and there will be winter, and it doesn't obviously happen in that linear cycle, but that we all go through the cycles of spring, summer, autumn and winter. And trying to hold on to an idea of like constant summer is so typical of our culture, because we want, you know, the never ending sunshine and, you know, the kind of consumerist dream of like, we can find a way to like rig this show and be always happy. But if you think about like the cycle of nature, the course of a day, you know, we go from night into day into night, and the course of a year, we go from, you know, in the parts of the world where you have seasons, that cycle of dark and light is so fundamental to nature and to us, that rather than lamenting the fact that psilocybin experience benefits tend to fade, I thought, well, we can embrace this, because there is a time of hibernation, there's a time of sitting and waiting and resting, thinking about depression as deep rest and allowing that process of, I don't need to get stuck in this winter forever. I can move through this cycle, but I'm going to allow myself this time of darkness. I think it's just about not getting stuck. That's the thing where depression becomes, you know, like incredibly debilitating, when the hope is lost and people feel that they're not going to be able to move through it. I think that's where it becomes so painful.
Okay. Well, I'm feeling a bit of a need to recalibrate here, because if we are just cycling through the seasons in our emotional lives, what the hell is the point of all this? It's like, maybe SSRIs are good enough. That New England Journal of Medicine article seems to suggest that. Maybe especially if it's paired with, you know, some kind of therapy. There's lots of therapists out there that can provide this work. Why do we need the fireworks, the hallucinations, the mystical experiences? Like, what's all the hype about then? What is psilocybin in the context of a therapy actually bringing that's unique and different and worthy of all the hope and promise?
Very, very good question. And I think it is that it enables people to go to those dark places and go through the cycles, because the thing about antidepressants is that what people describe about them is that it's numbing them. It's that it's cutting off the peaks and trough of experience, but they don't go to the winter. They're kind of kept in a kind of limbo land, and that they're not going into the depths of it and really learning from those places. And I'd say often in kind of talking therapy, yeah, with good talking therapy, you can really get down into the shadow, which is, you know, often the winter, the kind of the underworld, you can get down there, but it's really hard. And what I've learned about depression through this work is that I used to think about depression as like deep grief and sadness, like deep winter. But actually, I think for a lot of people, depression is just numbness and stuckness and feeling nothing.
Yes.
So actually being able to go to grief, being able to go down into that deep, dark cavern of despair that we all have, some people to a much greater degree, and really swim around in those deep, dark waters, but also connect. So that's the acceptance, going down into the water. And then there's the connection to values. So in that cycle of going down and going up, going around, it's like you can embrace a cycle of, I will accept my darkest feelings. I'm willing to feel them. I can open up to them. And when I've done that, I'm going to connect to the values of what that teaches me. And every time I go through the cycle, I'm learning more. I'm getting more gifts. I'm getting more resilient. And as you go through the cycle, you kind of hopefully come out the other side wise, experienced, able to hold pain and connect to beauty, rather than, you know, with other traditional, well, you know, kind of antidepressants, potentially not for everybody. Obviously, for some people, they just work brilliantly. But for a lot of people, antidepressants, you're not going on those big journeys of like acceptance and connection. You're just kind of staying in numbness. You're not going on the adventure. Psychedelics give us the adventure, the opportunity for the deep adventure.
So if you had a bit of a tear in your eye earlier, I think the tables have turned. I got the chills listening to you and some emotion coming up for me. Yeah, it's just really beautifully said. I appreciate that. And I wonder if I'm getting a bit of a feeling of what it's like to be your client or in one of your groups. It's beautiful. And actually a really nice opening to kind of get into the next questions I want to ask you. And really this thing about being stuck, right? That, and in fact, in many of the, you know, indications that we're targeting with psychedelic therapy in the research, really is about getting people unstuck, right? And you, I think, are very well known for highlighting the importance of really putting forward this notion of psychological flexibility and developing the ACE model. So I was hoping you could just tell us more about, you know, what psychological flexibility is and how you sort of landed on this model. And I think you got into it a little bit naming some of the dimensions of the ACE model. But yeah, can you just give us a little primer on that whole thing?
Yeah, sure. So psychological flexibility as a concept came from acceptance and commitment therapy originally. And I did a bit of postgraduate training in ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, and always really thought it was a really good model. And one of the main kind of foundational principles of ACT is of psychological flexibility, which is depicted as a hexaflex, which is a kind of hexagonal diagram, which basically has 6 points, 6 different processes that all together interrelate to create psychological flexibility. So the 6 processes are, let me see if I can remember them all. So there is diffusing from, so it's diffusion, and that is about detaching yourself from constant repetitive thinking and being able to have a distance between you and your thoughts. Then there is present moment awareness. So for me, that's about kind of coming out of the mind, thinking about the past or the future and coming into sensory engagement. So the breath, the body, the present moment. Then there is acceptance, and that's sometimes called willingness to feel. So that's really about emotion, really allowing those usually painful emotions, sometimes happy too. And then there is the observer self, or sometimes called self as context. And that is something about identifying with the larger self. So if the ego is the small self, the kind of the ego mind with its concerns and worries, the larger self is one metaphor. It's like the sky, not the weather. It's the bigger self that can watch the little self with its struggles and feel like it's larger. And then there is values, connecting to values, which is kind of obvious. And then the final one is committed action. So being able to actually do things in service of those values. And ACT therapists with clients will sometimes assess where somebody might be a bit stuck in one of these areas and where, like, think about interventions to help them boost that. And when I was doing qualitative research with the participants of the first psilocybin for depression study, I interviewed them all about what psilocybin had done, how it had helped them. And there were these two very strong themes that came through. The first was that psilocybin was helping them go from disconnection to connection. So they described that in depression, that they felt disconnected from themselves, the world around them, disconnected from their feelings, their bodies, and disconnected. And then after psilocybin, it was like this kind of concentric circle opening up of mind feeling more connected to their body, connecting to emotions, the body, connecting to other people, connecting to the world around them, nature, and connecting to a spiritual principle sometimes, or a sense of interrelatedness of all things. So that was the first theme. And the second theme was about people described going from avoidance of emotion to acceptance of emotion, being that before they'd been cutting off from emotion, distracting, numbing so much. You know, we all do so much numbing in our society. And they were going from that avoidance of emotion to acceptance of emotion, willingness to feel. So I was like, okay, this is, the hexaflex kept coming into my mind, and I kept thinking, this is so similar to what ACT was saying. So I cut the hexaflex in two and put 3 of the processes as a kind of acceptance triad and 3 of them as a connectedness triad. So one was about accepting feelings and the other was about connecting. And then when I looked at it, it was like a kind of like, yeah, like a, like almost like a circle with a blue half and a pink half, because I gave the acceptance blue and the connection was pink. And then I started looking at it and I was like, it looks like the sea and the sky. And then from there, I developed this idea of, I'm going to put the six processes in order of a journey. So then what it became is a pearl dive. So if you imagine like the surface of the sea, it's like got waves on it. It's like choppy waves. And the first process there is diffusing from your negative thoughts, like they are the waves of a sea constantly bashing against you. You know, you're swimming on the surface of the sea and wave after wave is just like psh, psh, in your face. That's the first process. The second one is you go into your body. So present moment awareness, come out of your head and into your body as you dive down beneath the surface of the sea, basically when you take the psilocybin, and you choose when you take the psilocybin to dive down from those surface level thoughts to diving down into your body, awareness of your felt sense. And then the third process is diving right down to the bottom of the sea. And there you see the murky kind of sandy layers. And that's all about where the horrible feelings or the really tricky, icky feelings are lying. And they were described as like oyster shells that were very spiky and unappealing, but that you should swim towards them and open them up and search through the slimy innards. Because by being with these experiences, you sometimes find the pearl, which is the meaning. And then the second half of the journey is you find the pearl and you swim up to the surface of the sea. And then you have that one, the observer self, the sky, not the weather. You look around yourself and you look around and you see everything differently because you've been on this journey. And then you connect to your values and then you connect to intentions about how to actually enact these values in your life from this moment forward. So that's the accept, connect, embody model of the analogy of a pearl dive as a psilocybin experience.
Very cool. So much to ask you about this. I wonder if we can do a little experiment here. And if you're not cool with this, we can edit it out. You've developed an actual meditative practice or like a visualization around everything that you just said. And it's quite beautifully done. I've heard you do it, you know, whatever it's the TED Talk or whatever videos you've done. And actually, which maybe I'll come back to this later, but we've actually incorporated the ACE model and psychological flexibility and the ACE body scan into our protocols at Numina. So it's incredibly exciting. And I'll hope to get a chance to tell you a story about a recent experience I had guiding a client with the ACE body scan, which is actually totally incredible.
Oh, wow. That makes me so happy. I can't wait to hear.
Yeah. I'm excited to share it with you. Would you be up for guiding me and the listeners through a brief, like maybe max 5 minute ACE body scan?
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
Yes.
Okay. I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. So imagine that you are on a beach and the waves are just lapping at your feet and it's very cool and relaxing. And then you're going to pick up some diving equipment that's lying there by your side. And you're going to walk to the surface of the water, the edge of the water where the water meets the beach. And you see a boat on the horizon and the boat's coming towards the beach where you are. And it's going to come and take you on a diving adventure. So you pick up the diving gear and the boat comes right up to the beach and you climb aboard. And then it sails back out to the center of the sea. And you sit there and you're sitting on a chair at the top of the boat. And it's a chair that's especially for you. And you can feel the sun on your face and you just feel that sun there on your forehead and on your cheeks and on the back of your neck. And just let that sun just kind of absorb into you for a moment. And then the ship goes right out to the center and it's going to be time for a dive. So you climb down the ladder on the side of the boat. And when you choose to dive down, you know that you're making a conscious decision to, for a moment, dive down from your mind into your body for a little while. So you're on the edge, you're on the ladder, and then with your diving equipment on, you dive down beneath the surface of the waves, and then you feel that sense of being held by the water. It's the warm water all around you and you dive down. And as you dive, just do a body scan. So as you're diving down, you imagine that your hands are diving down and just bring your awareness down through your body as you dive. So just Bring your awareness to the tips of your fingers surging down as you dive. And then as you surge down through the water, just bringing your awareness up through your hands and through your wrists, your arms, and then over your head, your forehead that's diving down, and then your cheeks, space behind your eyes, your neck, and then down through your torso, bring awareness to your heart, your lungs, and your belly, and then all the way down your torso, your hips, your thighs, your legs kicking as you dive down, and your knees, and your calves, your heels, and then the very tips of your toes. And then as you've done that, you can do that again in your own time now, just really doing a body scan from the from your tips of your fingers down to the tips of your toes. And as you do it, just breathe gently and just bring awareness to any part of your body where you feel any kind of tension or any kind of, just any sensations going on in your body. Just really breathe into them and let yourself feel them. So take a few moments just to really scan down from the tips of your fingers to the little points of your toes. And then what we're going to do is imagine that as you're swimming down, you get to the very bottom of the sea. And at the very, very lowest level of the sea, there's silt and sand and mud, and it's quite murky. And there are some oyster shells. And we're just going to go into one oyster shell now. And the oyster shell is going to be something that is difficult that you feel in your body somewhere. So any tension that you felt could be a tightness in your chest. It could be any sensation, anything that you felt going on there. Just imagine that that is an oyster tightly clasped at the bottom of the water, at the bottom of the ocean. And you're going to swim up to it and you're going to open the shell and you're going to open that feeling up in yourself, which means really allowing yourself to feel it. So breathe into that feeling, wherever you feel it in your body, as you open up this oyster shell and breathe into that place. And you're going to make that feeling a little bit bigger. So really allow it to be just as it is. Don't try and make it better or fix it. Just really breathe into that feeling and open it up and stay with it for a while. And as you let it grow, just have a little moment now of silence from me, where you're just imagining that you're searching that oyster for a pearl, some kind of insight, some kind of meaning about what this feeling in your body is actually trying to tell you. What is the message that this feeling gives your body? It doesn't have to be a great big insight. Just what is your body nodding to you and saying in this moment? So just stay with that feeling. And I'm going to leave you a minute to just really feel into it. And then I'll let you know when the minute is up and you can swim up to the surface of the sea with any pearls that you might have found. So you've got 1 minute from now to just really feel into that sensation and open up to it. And so now just imagine that you're putting that shell back down on the ocean floor. And if there's a pearl, that's great, but it's okay if there isn't. And you're going to swim up to the surface. So swim, kicking your legs as hard as you can, like really, really going for it. and imagine that you're surging up through the dark water to the place where the water becomes bluer and lighter and brighter. And you can feel the sun at the surface of the water, and then you burst through the top. And then you're just there with the sun on your face and the boat's right there to meet you. And you climb up the ladder, and then you're sitting there on top of the boat with a blanket around you in the sun, beautiful pink sky. And if you found a pearl, you can look down at that pearl and just remember a few things about what that pearl spoke to you of, about the sensations in your body. And then whenever you're ready, you can open your eyes.
Do I have to?
Or you can stay swimming around. I like to stay there.
Thank you, Roz.
Oh, pleasure. It's been a while since I went back to that one. So I don't know if I remembered all the parts right, but yeah, it's the general impression.
What do you normally ask people as they're coming out of a practice like that? Feel free to use me as a guinea pig if that's going to be helpful. Yeah, you don't have to, but just it's available.
Were you able to kind of engage with it? Did you feel like you could go there? I mean, obviously it was a short one. Did you feel that you could engage with it?
Very much. And I mean, I do have a meditation practice. So this kind of thing is sort of just a regular thing, but also just, you know, a little bit of nervousness and just being very alert with this interview and stuff. So I feel, you know, quite activated, just kind of alive and alert. So that might have contributed to, you know, just having an experience, I guess.
Mm. Could you say a few words about it if it's not too exposing?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. So I found the visualization, like it took me a second to sort of click in. I didn't know if I should like lie back or close my eyes, but I sort of like landed and the visualization just like popped in pretty clear. I'm taking a sun vacation in about a month. So that whole thing's a little bit on my mind. But yeah, just the beach and the water and yeah, it just sort of felt familiar, felt relatively vivid. This piece about the chair on the boat just for me felt really nice, felt really supportive. And then, yeah, I guess the piece about that transition from having a, you know, a bit of a cognitive visualization and then transitioning to sort of directing attention into the body felt very clear. And I have a lot of things happening in my body right now, just speaking to what I said earlier about being a little activated. And then there was a little bit of sort of running like which of these sort of sensations or groups or patterns of sensations are going to kind of like come to the fore as the one that I sort of connect to, I guess. Mm. And I landed on one and it just sort of amplified and it had this sort of like warmth kind of like emanating out from my lower chest, upper belly kind of thing. And, you know, definitely some emotion came with it and kind of smile came over my face. And and then kind of coming back up, I had the sense of like kind of surging up and then like coming out into the sunlight. And it was quite nice. And something welcoming about the boat and the sunset, or, you know, I think you mentioned like a pink sky. So yeah, it was very vivid. Aww. I don't know if that, answers your question or maybe over answers your question.
No, it's lovely. I'm so glad. It's beautiful when people are able. I mean, I'm actually really bad at visualization myself. I find it really hard to get into it. So it's amazing when people, because that was so quick and you were able to switch from, you know, doing a podcast interview to that place of really seeing so clearly, so quickly. So yeah, I'm in awe. It's very cool when people can do that.
Cool. So you would ask people to just maybe report back what they experienced and then what? Is it just sort of open up from there, or are there specific things you inquire into? I'm guessing you and I could do a deep dive into exactly what the emotion was and what the body sensations were, and that becomes a great trailhead for therapy. Yes, am I getting that right?
Yeah, exactly. And actually so this visualization would be done, a long version, it would be done in the prep session the day before psilocybin. So so we're asking people to imagine that tomorrow you're going to be going on this journey when you take the psilocybin. So it's like, you're already introducing a little bit of like anticipatory anxiety to people as well, and sometimes excitement. So you're doing it with them on the bed that they're going to be having psilocybin on the next day, with the headphones on, although slightly to the side, and the eye shades and the music playing. So it's kind of like a practice run for the actual psilocybin deep dive. And they have two therapists either side holding their hands if they want to. So we're really running through. So the purpose of the visualization is partly for them to gain a language for sensations, but also crucially to communicate them with their therapist, because one of the things I found in the first study is that people would be going through all sorts of stuff inside and sometimes really want to connect with the guide, the person next to them, and tell them about what was going on to help them kind of move through it. But they didn't know how to reach out or ask for help or get support because they felt so far away and they just didn't know how to. So by doing this visualization the day before, we were kind of practicing how it feels to have a feeling and communicate it with us. Like often in the psilocybin experience, they wouldn't need to, but just so that if they did need to, we'd practice it. So when we did the visualization, we would say, so, you know, can you find an oyster? And actually people would live report what was going on. So they'd say, yeah, I'm feeling an oyster of this. And they would talk us through what they were feeling in the moment. And so it just enabled us to have that connection with them of like, I'm here with you side by side. We're connected in your experience. So that if people wanted to connect with the guides, they could. So that was kind of the other purpose of it. Communication.
So you wouldn't do this during a psilocybin session?
So it would be the day before. Then we didn't do it during the session itself, but I would really like to. I imagine that it would be a really nice way to begin people and like start the session off.
I'll tell you quickly, I know we're unfortunately getting low on time here. I could just do this for much longer, but I do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy.
Yes.
And I'm working right now with a client who does have a hard time getting out of her head.
Mm.
And on the second medicine session, she took the ketamine and we waited for it to sort of come on. And she said, I feel like I'm resisting the medicine coming on a little bit. I don't know what to do. And we chatted a little bit about the different options. I ended up sitting on the ground next to her and guiding her through an ACE body scan.
Mm.
Not anywhere near as elegantly as you just did, but you know, the key elements were there. And what was part of what was cool about it for me, which I don't normally get in a body scan that I'd be guiding in like a mindfulness-based stress reduction group or something, is like, it was a bit interactive. I would ask her to tell me about the sensations. And we just sort of landed in this part of her chest that's normally quite tight when she feels anxious. And she was describing kind of opening and a peacefulness there, which was quite unusual for her. And then, you know, we sort of just kind of like winded it down. She put on her headphones and then just took off.
Mm.
And she had like a really beautiful journey. And I really felt like the body scan helped disarm the resistance a little bit.
Yes.
And it was like just that whole process of like having the experience of like holding tight, resisting, and then letting go was incredibly therapeutic. But then everything that happened on the medicine was also really interesting too. So pretty awesome. Pretty awesome.
That's wonderful. Yeah. It's so brilliant to hear. Yeah, to share those stories. It's, yeah, lovely to hear. I hope there'll be lots more in the future where we can all, you know, this model and all the other models that are going to develop, there are going to be so many, you know, great ways of working. And yeah, it'll be nice when all the people, the community is developing, and it's lovely to share with. I mean, that's the whole learning of all of it. It's just how nice it is, you know, psilocybin adventures, journeys, or psychedelic experiences, there's a lot about the idea of the hero's journey, like the individual journey that we go on individually, but it's something about the shared journey that we, you know, you come back down from the mountain and you tell people about it, or just, you know, going through the journey together. It feels to me like that's kind of really important of what we need right now.
Yes, totally agree. Maybe I can squeeze in one question. I want to give you an opportunity to say more about the projects you're working on and then land this in the next 8 minutes. So let's see what we can do. I find it very cool that you're actually doing this work in a few different settings, a few different contexts. So yes, the academic research. Mm-hmm. There's the work you've done in industry as well. Mm-hmm. And now I guess something along the lines of clinical practice or private practice with these integration groups that you're doing. I'm just really curious. And again, you know, we can talk at length about this, but maybe just some initial thoughts about mm-hmm. what it's like working in these different contexts and sort of the broader kind of challenge of integrating these very mm-hmm. mysterious and very complex substances and experiences into kind of mainstream life with their rich history and yes. different lineages and stuff. So yeah, maybe just some thoughts there.
Yeah, I think my thought there is, so I guess like an analogy that came to me the other day, I love analogies. Another water one is like thinking of the mainstream as like a stream and like the river and psychedelics coming in like a little stream to the side. And so there's two ways that can work. Either you get the mainstream, the river and the stream, and that the stream affects the river. It has an impact on the river. So psychedelics come in with their unique ways of working and the lessons, their teachings, and they affect the mainstream. So the mainstream changes because it's being accommodating this new way of working, these new value system. Or the other way is that actually the stream gets changed by the mainstream, like the river effect, like almost dilutes it or takes away its essence because it then just gets diluted into the mainstream. And I think in a way both will happen. I think it can't be either or, but that if we're aware of the great loss, the great sadness and the great injustice, if the particular essence, spirit of this amazing stream coming in, if that was lost to the mainstream, then that would be a great tragedy. Because when I think about what the spirit of it is, the essence of it is, it is about interconnectedness, that is the teacher. So many indigenous groups and cultures have the same teachings around all things are connected. Like, you know, the mycorrhizal networks that connect all the trees and the forest, like, we're learning more and more about the way our ecosystems work, and it is through interconnectedness. And so if that's what the essence of psychedelics are about, their plants, they're telling us about interconnectedness, the importance of interconnectedness and how much we need that, then if we lose that message and they become co-opted into the mainstream and they become just another part of kind of capitalistic drug culture, like pharma companies giving it as yet another, you know, intervention, and that the spirit is lost, it will be, I think psychedelics will lose their power and potentially be unsafe. And this amazing treasure that has been carried through generations and generations of indigenous groups that have carried these traditions would be so unbearable. It would be so unbearable to watch that lost, and so unbearable for the people who have the underground therapists who have for a long time kind of carried these healing techniques at great personal risk because they really believe in this. It would just be so sad. So what can we do to, you know, make sure that the essence doesn't get lost? I think it's really hold true to our values about what makes, like the question you asked before, what makes psychedelics different? Know what's different and hold strong about not fitting that circle into a square shaped hole, but instead making the whole circle, not square.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good. Yeah. I appreciate your leadership on this. And I hope that. What's that?
I don't know about that. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to say it, but it's another thing to do it.
Right. Yeah, no, it's very challenging, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. If we can learn enough from the people who've been doing it the circle way, not the square way, mm-hmm. then we might be able to circle our square. But we have to listen.
Hmm. Okay, Roz, tell us about your projects and what you want people to know. How do people find you? What are you working on these days? What's important to you right now?
So my main project these days is starting a psychedelic community for anyone that is doing psychedelic experiences, whether in clinical trials or retreats or at home. a community for people to go through this process together. So it's a year-long program. And it's based around the Celtic tree calendar. So every month there's a different tree and the tree has a lesson. And whereas before we had the analogy of the pearl dive and psychological flexibility as the six processes of that, now the psychological flexibility processes are kind of spread around 12 trees that we go through the seasons with. So it's the whole idea of going through the seasons. It's kind of difficult to explain, but it's not yet launched, but I do have a waiting list for anyone that wants to sign up and just get more information when it comes. So that can be, I have just a one-page website, which is basically just this kind of sign-up sheet, which is drrosalindwatts.com. And that has, yeah, so if people are interested in hearing more, they can sign up to that. It's all about building connectedness to self, other people, and nature. And there are lots of kind of nature metaphors in the program, and there's visualizations. The pearl dive visualization has now become 12 tree journeys, and they've all got amazing music from my friend John Hopkins I have some of his music in the as part of these meditations, and also some amazing musicians are making music, bespoke music for these tree journeys. So they've all got beautiful music as part of the meditations, and there's also breath work and lots of other tools. So it's a full-on kind of program with breath work, meditation, visualization, and importantly, the community and the sharing circles to be with other people. And then just very quickly, the other thing I wanted to tell people about was my very dear friend, Anya, who is the co-director of the Psychedelic Society in the UK, has been filming various people in the psychedelic renaissance for the last 5 years and is making a film really trying to show the development of this field and the shadow side as well, particularly. And she just needs a little bit of extra funding to get the editing done. And it's a film that I really think we will all really benefit from watching, because it really tracks the development. So that's psychedelicrenaissance.com if people feel like they want to donate some money to that.
Awesome. Well, put links in the show notes and maybe some of the images that you referred to. We were talking about the ACE model and stuff, so yes, Everyone can have a look. Once again, thank you so much, Roz. This was a lot of fun. Hope to do it again sometime soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. All right, take care.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.